For thousands of years, nomads and settled people have coexisted. Yet the stories of those who roam with their herds and have no permanent address usually plays a very small part in our recorded history. Nomadic people do have an oral history. That dates back to Neolithic times, and their story is so often misunderstood or not even told at all. British author Anthony Satin has compiled a lifetime of stories about the restlessness that makes us feel human in his book. It's called Nomads, the Wanderers Who Shaped Our World. And he joins us today to talk about the shifting relationships between nomads and settled communities over the last 12,000 years. Anthony, thanks so much for being here.
Rick, thanks for having me on the show.
My goodness, I've long been fascinated by nomads, and you've written the book that gives us an insight as if we've traveled with all of these communities. And you wrote your book about nomads, and then I understand you kind of have a nomadic existence going from London to Umbria. Is there any connection with your fascination with nomadic communities and the fact that you're not that settled yourself?
No, I've been on the move for a long, long time, all my adult life. I'm beginning to settle in my sort of later age.
Okay. Well, you've got that nomadic spirit, it sounds like.
Yeah, no, I'm still moving.
What got you interested in nomads in the beginning?
You know, when I left high school, I went traveling around the Middle East. I was camping on the Sinai Peninsula, which was then occupied by Israel and is now part of Egypt. And has always been home to nomads, to Bedouin, because you can't farm it. And everybody had said to me, oh, watch out when you go there, because, you know, the nomads are going to steal from you. You better sleep with your passport down and your money down your sleeping bag. And I was sleeping out on the beach. And I had completely opposite experience. These wonderful people who thought it was a bit odd, that because at that time there were no hotels or shops or whatever on the Sinai Peninsula. It was really just sort of barren desert. Yeah. And they were thinking, how is this guy going to look after himself? I was there with a friend. We'd come from school and we'd come with as much bread as we could carry and chocolate spread and water, bottled water, to see how long we could survive. And these guys looked after us. And that was sort of completely not my expectation,
right?
What people had told me.
So babes in the wilderness there.
Yeah, exactly. And then jump forward about 10, 12 years and I'd settled in Cairo. And, you know, nomads, when you live in Cairo, no, they're not part of your everyday, but they are part of the periphery. You know, people do have an awareness and an understanding of nomadic culture. And I got back to London and thought, it's really odd. We just don't think about it. You know, in Europe, it's just not part of the story.
How do you define nomad?
You know, the meaning changes a lot over time, but it's a very, very old word. It goes back to sort of early Indo-European, so right at the very beginning of language. The word was nomos, and it's either sort of having animals that need pasture or having the right to take your animals onto a piece of land. But it's absolutely connected to having animals that need to be fed.
It's almost by definition animal herders that roam with the needs of their animals.
Exactly that. And it's good to remember, for instance, the majority of our planet is not suited for agriculture. It's suited for herding.
That's right.
Most nomads move their flocks from summer to winter pastures. And it might be in and out of the desert. So if you're, for instance, in Arabia or North Africa, you'll move your animals into the desert in the winter because there's grazing, and you'll move them out because everything burns up in the summer.
I remember these days when I used to sleep with my money belt at the bottom of my sleeping bag, too. That's just one generation ago, really. And I remember nomadic communities we were aware of that in these communities because they'd come in to trade and so on. And there's been quite a change, even in our lifetime. And in your book, you talk about in human history how we've gone from, 100% of everybody being nomadic. And today, it must be less than 1%. It's an interesting dynamic. What is there, like almost 8 billion people on the planet now? How many nomads would you estimate there are? And I would imagine to answer that, you got to define nomadic and semi-nomadic.
I mean, I think the point to make about that is, about 12,000 years ago, which is more or less when I start my book, we all lived on the move as hunter-gatherers. And I don't think the population of mobile people, let's call them mobile communities, has changed dramatically since then. I mean, I think it's thought there's about 40 million people living nomadic lives, pastoralists in the world. What's changed is the settled community has gone from, a million to a billion and now to 8 billion or whatever. And, you know, that's the huge change. And the great joy of looking at nomads and writing about them is realizing this has just been the constant. You know, they've just carried on doing what they've always done.
Yeah. I was just in Palestine, and we were meeting with some Bedouins, and they were talking about, because of the complexities of the modern world and how things are stacked against nomadic lifestyles, they were begrudgingly having to be more settled, but they were still semi-nomadic. Is that a way that nomadic communities are surviving now, is having to compromise a little bit with their free spirits?
Yeah, absolutely. And governments all over the place are doing their best to get nomads to settle. That's really what's at the core of my book, and that is this suspicion of settled people, of those who live on the move. You know, where have they come from? Where are they going? Why have they come here? They must be carrying drugs. They must be smuggling arms. Yeah. They must be all that stuff. But
there is that tension between governments and nomadic people. That's probably nothing new.
No, not at all. And I mean, certainly, you know, I track it back about 100 years in my book. But I write about this tribe, the Bakhtiari in Iran, who are still doing what they've been doing for, you know, they claim for 1,000, 2,000 years. But I know they've been doing this for 150 years because there are good records of them. And they all complain that their numbers are dwindling because the government offers them, you want your children to be part of the modern world? Well, they need to go to school. Well, we can provide them with a dormitory and an education. And then it's very difficult for the kids to go back into the nomad life.
Yeah.
And the same for elderly people. You want your elderly people to be looked after in old age?
You know, Anthony, I experienced the same thing in eastern Turkey with the Kurdish nomads. If I understood it correctly, Ankara, you know, the national government of Turkey, offered them land and houses and schools, and they'd build their own fences for them, essentially. And the people, they didn't even want the free property, or they didn't want the education, because it was a conspiracy against their own way of living.
It is, and it's much harder to control people if they're not of any fixed address. That's the point.
Anthony Satin's our guest from his home in the mountains above Perugia in Italy right now on Travel with Rick Steves. He's a fellow with the Royal Geographic Society, and he's hosted travel documentaries for the BBC. Anthony investigates how nomadic peoples have shaped civilization in his book, Nomads, The Wanderers Who Shaped Our World. Anthony also specializes in historical works on Egypt and North Africa. Some of his earlier books look into Florence Nightingale's travels on the Nile and how T.E. Lawrence became Lawrence of Arabia. His website is anthonysatin.com, spelled S-A-T-T-I-N. Anthony, we're talking about the relationship between nomads and settled people. And when I think of nomads, I guess a lot of people would think of Attila the Hun and Genghis Khan, these guys that were just like walking mass producers of death. It's not a very good cover child for the image of nomadic life.
No, not at all. And that's another reason why I wanted to write this book, because, you know, you mentioned earlier that nomadic people have an oral tradition. That's how they preserve their stories. And the only time they get a look in at our settled histories is when there's trouble. And, you know, I studied history at high school, and I came out of it being able to name check three nomads, Attila the Hun, Genghis Khan, and Tamerlane. You know, and they are the world's great, presented as the world's great killers. And it's true, they killed lots of people, but that's not all they did. And that in no way reflects the reality of the relationship between nomads and settled, even in those troubled times. For instance, I write about quite a lot about Genghis Khan and Timur, or Tamerlane, as he's called in the West, who really changed the world. For instance, without the Mongol Renaissance, as I call it, the world that Timur brings into creation at the end of the 1300s, the beginning of the 1400s, we wouldn't have had a European Renaissance in the way we had it and when we had it. You know, he is the facilitator of so much because he opens up the link between China and the West.
It's so important that we recognize that, you know, the winners get to write the history and so on, and particularly societies that have written history have an advantage over communities that don't have a written history. But when we think of the world, we think of it in terms of the empire of Alexander the Great, or the Roman Empire, or the Ottoman Empire. But there's another overlay or underlay, which would be the nomadic peoples that lived there before and to a certain extent live there today. And in your book, you're sort of creating an ability to see the world from from that perspective. Isn't that part of your goal in writing this book?
There was a lovely description of history from an Oxford and Princeton eminent historian. And he describes it as a path picked through ruins. And so the only role that a nomad who doesn't build monuments could have in this version of history is as the creator of ruins, somebody who destroys things. And that just doesn't reflect the reality. I mean, nomads are the great survivors.
Well, here's the reality then, because you open and close your book with hanging out with the Bakhtiari, nomadic tribe in Iran, right? You know, you were just like hanging out with them. Can you give us a vivid image, other than some guy on a horse with a big sword chopping off the heads of settled people? Can you give us a more intimate look at what you learned by actually sort of embedding yourself with the Bakhtiaris? How did they eat, sleep, work, relax, govern themselves, that sort of thing?
It's an eye-opener to spend time with nomadic people, because probably the most important thing that occurred to me while I was with these people, and, you know, they're living in their tents and I'm sleeping in a tent, you know, just beside their camp, was their absolute understanding of their relationship with their surroundings, with the natural world. You know, this is absolutely cool. We, 50% of humans now live in an urban environment, most of us in apartments. You know, no sense of connection with the natural world. Well, here are people who it's absolutely, you know, essential and relevant to every moment of every day. And it's not just a question of, is it going to rain today? It's a question of, what do we do with the changing climate? What do we do with, you know, because their absolute necessity is to find pasture for their animals, or their animals die. And so they're in a very, very real and vital relationship with their surroundings. And that...
kind of fundamental.
Extraordinary and electrifying. But also the hospitality, the openness, the welcome. I was staying with one family, but I traveled around in the valleys we're up in, you know, about sort of 3,000 meters up in the mountains in Iran, and it's spring. The valleys are carpeted with beautiful spring flowers. The snow is melting off the high peaks, so the streams are all rushing around. It's a happy time for these people. They've made the journey up from the Mesopotamian plain down near the Iraqi border, where it's got really hot. And they'll stay up in the mountains till it starts freezing, and then they'll go down again. And they...
Anthony, don't they know they should be happier if they had more material possessions? Don't they just... don't the children wish they had a bigger variety of shoes and...
Well, they do have some. No, they do have some. For instance, I was surprised to see one tent really brightly lit at night. So I went in, and they're there watching television. And I'm thinking, wait, this isn't right. Nomads can't watch television up in the mountains. They did. They had a car battery and solar panels and all that stuff. But the essential thing is they can only have what they can move with. And, you know, and now some of them are moving with trucks between their summer and winter pastures. But, you know, they live light. And that's another thing
where they need to go to have their herds be able to eat and drink. I mean, that's the basic thing. You know, I really appreciated in your book, you wrote at the beginning, all humankind lived on the move across a world in which the only barriers were the natural ones of forest, river, mountain, and desert, and the ones that were man-made were from branches and thorns. By the end of your book, then, you wrote, wanderers must now pick their way across a world divided by borders, highways, and walls, and by the international agreements made by nation states. Boy, Anthony, that's a tough reality for nomadic communities to deal with, all that change just in the basic freedom to roam.
It is really tough, and it has serious consequences for them. But let's remember that effectively I'm writing about all of us in this book. It's a tough reality for all of us. And one of my motives for writing this book, it was my Brexit protest. It's my protest at walls going up all over the place, you know, in the US, in the UK, and, you know, this is a reality for settled and nomadic peoples, and it's not made the world any better, I think. And one of the points I wanted to make in the book is that the happiest, the greatest, most exciting, and most successful periods in human history are the times when there's been freedom of movement.
The role of nomads over the centuries and how these wanderers have shaped our world. That's the focus of Anthony Satin's latest book, Nomads. There's been DNA research that suggests that a tendency to roam may be related to the same genes that are associated with what we call attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Anthony and I discuss that, plus the early American settlers who preferred the nomadic life of their Native American neighbors over living in their colonies. It's in an extra to our conversation. You can hear it with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Anthony, I'm fascinated by nomadic peoples in the Americas and actually across the Arctic. And I'm kind of aware that there's a lot of different groups across the Arctic, and there's a lot of different groups of indigenous peoples who are no longer allowed to be nomadic in the Americas. They survive. What do they have in common when you think about these communities that seem separated, but the more you look at it, the more they are similar?
Yes, there are lots of similarities between them. And the fundamental one is that sense of being at peace and at home in the natural world. There's also a way of thinking that comes with living in the natural world, living, you know, without certainty every day. And it's a sort of, it has been called nomadic thinking, and it's a divergent way of looking at things. It's having multiple solutions to every day.
Do nomadic communities have some kind of government? I mean, it seems interesting to me that they don't have a single voice when it comes to dealing with challenges from outside their communities.
No, there are nomadic congresses across Eurasia and things like that. But no, there's no central gathering. More's the pity, really, because they do, as you say, have so much in common across the Americas and across the world. But hasn't been in the interest of any of the settled governments to allow nomadic peoples to gather together.
Anthony Satin, this is so fascinating. Thank you for writing your book, Nomads, the Wanderers Who Shaped Our World. And Anthony, reading through your book, there were so many moments that you had with nomadic peoples that just would be an inspiration if any of us could share those. Can you just take one favorite moment where you recognized the nobility and the beauty of this way of life that is actually quite seriously threatened?
The moment that springs to mind is one I haven't written about. I was back in Sinai Desert about 15 years ago and trekking, and I came across a couple of tents, and a man came out, you know, curious, invited me in, gave me a cup of tea, went and got his sort of, it was like a homemade banjo from a metal dish and a stick he'd put up and some wire he'd strung, started playing music for me, you know, and the hospitality is just so extraordinary and welcoming. You know, and then eventually he came around to say, well, what are you doing here? And what's your story? Mm. And then, you know, very, very quickly, there's an engagement going on. And I'm telling him things he doesn't know, and he's telling me things I don't know. And I just find that sort of encounter is always the case with nomads, and is increasingly less the case with settled people.
This is a fascinating way that we can learn about our own society, our own communities, our own civilization by leaving them and looking at them from a distance, from a different perspective, perhaps from a perspective of a nomadic community. Anthony Satin, thanks for joining us and best wishes with your writing and raising awareness of the beauty and the plight of nomadic communities across our planet.
Rick, thanks. It's been a pleasure talking.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton, Kazmer Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Our website is managed by Andrew Wakeling. Our theme music was written and performed by Jerry Frank. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. You can find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.